Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, art, and whoever else we can find that's out there trying to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Eric Kessel. Emiliano Gandolfi will be joining us in a second with a couple of remarkable guests, but first, welcome to 2018. We learned a lot in 2017 and talked with extraordinary practitioners from all over the globe. We're going to keep doing that. All of our previous episodes can be found on our website at socialdesigninsights.com. If this is your first time joining the show, have a browse through our archive. There's plenty to entertain and inspire. We wanted to begin 2018 with a look back and a look forward. Social Design Insights arose out of a series of discussions within the Curry Stone Foundation about how far the social design movement had come since the founding of the prize 10 years ago. We've had the opportunity to meet some remarkable people in the last 10 years and wanted you to meet them too. Thus, Social Design Insights was born. To have that conversation, we decided to invite Cliff Curry and Delight Stone for our first episode of 2018. They are the founders of the Curry Stone Design Prize, and we wanted to learn a little bit about them, their journey, their vision for the future. As Social Design Insights enters its second year, and the Curry Stone Foundation enters its second decade, we wanted to bring you all a sneak peek into all the things that are coming up in the coming year and the years ahead. Let's listen in. Cliff, Delight, welcome to the show. Obviously, you're no stranger to it, and we're sure that you've listened to every episode, but it's good to finally get you on here and help us kick off 2018.
Thank you.
Cliff, Delight, we thought we might begin by introducing your histories to our audience. Could you tell us a little bit about how you came to this? What was the arc of your life that ended up in the creation of the Curry Stone Foundation and the Curry Stone Design Prize, and for that matter, this podcast?
Oh my goodness. That was, there's been a lot of history, because I'm now mid-70s. I've had career experiences building houses, being a planning director in Bloomington, Indiana, doing urban renewal in Salem, Oregon, and working doing senior housing and basically inventing a new kind of senior housing back in the 70s. That is probably the arc that I've been able to use my architecture and city planning the most and to the most effect, if you will.
What was really the moment in which you really saw the interest and the potential of design entering into making better societies and better communities?
Probably the Whole Earth Catalog, when that came out. It came out in a milieu that I was involved with, which was groups that were around Bloomington and were involved in environmental issues at the beginnings of those kinds of concerns, or at least in my life. And so that's probably the key seminal event.
And that had an impact in your practice?
Well, this was before our practice, this is more formative years. You know, when I'm starting in college, I didn't know really what I wanted to do. And so I took classes each year. I was at Indiana. They had lots of classes. I would pick what I wanted, whether it be ancient Near Eastern history or mathematics or sculpture, and I took all those courses. So it was later when I had a practice doing architecture planning.
And Delight, you are not an architect.
No, I'm not. I'm actually a historical archaeologist.
What is that?
It's an archaeologist that studies culture and people and uses not only the artifacts that you find in the ground that people usually think of, but also documents, photographs, maps. Some people call historical archaeologists people that work with capitalism or industrialism, but I prefer something that's a lot broader and includes certain types of writing styles in South America that are done with cords or fabrics. And I have a little bit broader definition of that. But from a historical archaeologist, housing and buildings are just simply large artifacts, and they reflect culture. And when I got my master's, I looked at a territorial period house and site in the Oregon Territory and treated the house as a large artifact and then excavated it looking for cultural changes over time as the building itself changed. So I guess I've always been interested in culture and in building and in community my entire academic and professional career.
And when was the moment in which you guys felt the need to give more resonance to the social impact of design and, you know, went beyond your own practice to support something that was larger?
Well, I think we always had. I think what had changed over time is the amount of energy and money and time that we commit to it. During Cliff's architectural career, we both served on various commissions. I was on the Landmarks Commission. He was in various neighborhood groups, and we always donated our time. And as we had more disposable income, we were actually able to match that with cash.
Was there a particular moment where it occurred to you, hey, we're going to start this foundation, we're going to start this design prize? How did that come about?
It came about really with an economic change that happened for us. The company that we helped found and operate was at the forefront of this kind of large movement to do senior housing. And we were able to do an inordinate amount of it. When that company sold right before the crash, then that was the time where we could try to make something that would give back. And so that's what we did.
At the time, we were reading two books. One was Design Like You Give a Damn, and the other book was The Fifth Sacred Thing by Starhawk. And so we were thinking about community and what could we do to positively impact community, and we came up with this idea.
But already the senior housing had a very community-driven perspective, right? Could you maybe tell us a bit more about how you invented and developed this scheme?
Well, what we discovered was that people are living longer, and as that process happens, people are often lose a spouse and they're living alone and they're lonely. So what we figured out was if you created a community, a place where community could happen, a place that people could enjoy being and have their own private space but still have a lot of community area, then it might be popular. And what we found out is it was wildly popular. And it's been that, you know, for the whole run. Now there's all kinds of senior housing. But when we started, there really were nursing homes, basically.
But how did design actually, build a community? Because you had specific features in helping people get together, or was it simply, you know, bringing many rooms together and that would create a community?
Well, that's an interesting question because of course, there's a lot of ways to do it. But basically what we did is we had a common area, and that common area had an atrium, and the atrium then allowed everybody on every one of the floors to be able to look down and communicate visually with the rest of the buildings, the rest of the community. Around that, you'd have the dining room, which would be a place where people would gather three times a day for meals. And they'd be then traversing from their apartments, which are their private places, into that dining room. But as they do that, they're passing the library. Well, we didn't do the library where it was a closed-off room. It was open, so people could interrupt. So we did a lot of things like that. And we developed a number of things over time, which generated conversations and friendships.
Then in addition to the building, there was a programming and there were certain sets of job requirements. So we had live-in managers and live-in assistant managers. They were couples. They poured coffee or tea at all meals so that they were moving between tables, having conversation with people, just making sure that people were feeling good and were doing well and giving people an opportunity to communicate with them. Additionally, there was a series of activities internal to the buildings, exercise, art, a beauty shop. There was a room that the men could retreat to and play pool, and also a lot of activities where people came in and had meals with residents, and there was a social component to that that I think was really good for bringing people out of isolation.
And it sounds like there's a strong connective tissue between the design sensibilities that you cultivated doing this work and the eventual winners of the Curry Stone Design Prize. Over a decade, you awarded 26 prizes to various designers who reflected a similar sort of concern for the human in the design process.
There's many ways to evaluate practices that try to bring social impact, but one specific is the ability to create community. That means bringing people together with a common, also political understanding of what are the experiences that they're going through and what are the potentials. And this is something that actually, I think, really came also through the experience that Cliff and Delight had in their private life. So it's something that developed through the process and became somehow the fundaments of what the prize then became.
I think that's true. As we were doing things, we didn't really try to control who won. We had the jurors, we've had, Emiliano from the start and others who helped create this. And so we didn't actually pick anybody, although, you know, we had things to say. But as it's turned out, we have a lot of people that have a lot in common, just in terms of their industriousness and entrepreneurship and ability to see problems and do something about it. And it's that doing something about it that really encompasses everybody that we've awarded a prize to.
And I would add passion, because it's all people that have a great passion in really putting themselves in the forefront of change.
That's true. So it's a great group to be associated with.
I think it's also particularly interesting that your initial projects, Cliff, that were more in urban planning, were really looking at ways in which citizens could become directly involved and become responsible for seeing the city as a place for opportunities. So could you maybe tell us a bit more about the approach that you had?
Yeah, I basically started my city planning, urban design kind of experience back in the late 60s, early 70s, while I was actually still a student at Kentucky Architecture School. I took a job with the city of Bloomington, Indiana, as its first planning director. That was the time when the federal government was putting money into cities doing planning. Bloomington got some of that money, put me in as the planning director, and I had the opportunity to start from scratch to create a master plan for the city, as well as a zoning ordinance and some urban renewal things to implement it.
And from the planning perspective, that seems to make a natural segue into the housing work, which came later. Can you give us a sense of what was that? It was senior housing, but at what scale and what drew you into it?
I connected up with a small-time developer in Salem, Oregon, back in 1977. He had had some experience with senior housing, not much. The company didn't hang together. But we connected, and over a course of actually 30 years, we did some 350 projects all across North America. All the provinces in Canada, all but just a couple of states in the country, and then we also did some work overseas. And the thing that was unique about what we did is that we did the whole thing. It was, we'd go out and find a site, we'd get all the governmental approvals for it, we'd design it, we'd, with our construction company, built it, I would design it and sign each of them, and then we would own it and we'd manage it. So we bought the sites and we bought the bacon and eggs at the other end of it and continued on into long-term management. So at that point, we were the largest, by far, owner-operator of senior housing.
What we did that was a little bit different than what many people do is we took our profit in equity. So we actually kept our fee for service at the absolute minimum that we could live on, which was beans and rice and rolling out a futon on the office floor sometimes.
Which we did actually for several years.
For several years. And then we took the long view and said, profit will come when these things are profitable. So it was our intention to stay involved with the people that lived in our buildings. And through the management company, we were able to stay involved. And so we had not planned on selling ever. Eventually, there was enough volume that we were able to actually make some money, but it took a really long time.
What I would also add, Delight, that is remarkable, is that usually architects deliver a building and then they forget about it. But while you were managing, you would have all the numbers and the insights and the understanding of how to improve the future buildings, but also you would have continuity. So it's not simply about, you know, housing some people with a structure, but it's really, you know, keeping care of them for years. And so managing how much salt you need, and also, you know, where to position that window or that corridor so that people will actually sit there and you know, meet. I think it's really interesting to see how many details can come out from this process. That is, it's really a full management and taking care of a community of dwellers. It's not just, you know, delivering a building and forgetting about it.
That's totally true. It's a very different approach to things to have a long-term client that when you think about it, I calculated the other day that there's been somewhat over 3 million seniors that have lived in our facilities.
And one of them was my grandmother, and it gave us great pleasure to have her move in and to live there until the end.
You're listening to Social Design Insights. We hope you've been enjoying this discussion between Cliff, Delight, Emiliano, and myself, but we're going to take a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights after the break. Welcome back to Social Design Insights. We've been speaking with Cliff Curry and Delight Stone, the founders of the Curry Stone Foundation and the Curry Stone Design Prize, about how all of this came to be and what's next. Let's rejoin the conversation.
It always amazes me, like, how much your story has in common with the stories of some of these winners. And, you know, Emiliano and I have been listening to these stories once a week for the last year, and it's very easy to understand how your experiences grew into this prize and informed its values, even if you guys weren't, you know, picking winners. You kind of did.
I think we kind of did.
with your ethic and your spirit, I think, you know, it's easy to see your fingerprints on it, that's all.
Yeah.
I think that what's really interesting of the career of Cliff and Delight is that it's really this approach of caring about people and thinking that architecture can really be the mean to care. And not only as a building, but also as a strategy, as a way of thinking and thinking how communities can come together. So I think it was particularly interesting in this phase, shifting from having one winner every year, or maybe up to 5 winners every year, to recognizing an entire community of practices that out there are really working on the forefront on the most dramatic and urgent crisis on a world scale. And try to recognize, you know, a larger recipient of people as really people that are having an impact. So I think that, you know, that shift that can be somehow seen also more democratic. So going outside of the realm of celebrating the best, but just going to see all the actual people that are, you know, making a difference in their community and trying also to give them a voice in a more international platform. Was, I think, a fundamental shift for this year. Which were some of the interviews that you really thought were more inspiring or that opened up to a perspective that you didn't think before?
Two of my favorites were the engineer Himanshu Parikh and then Mayor John Fetterman. I like their practical ethic, and it makes sense to me to look at an issue like poverty, which can be overwhelming to anyone that even looks at it, let alone works in the area where there's a great deal of poverty. And I just think they've got unique approaches that in some ways any of us could do. So those were two of my favorites.
Cliff?
Oh my, no, I don't really have a favorite. I think the thing that's really been remarkable is that we've been able to have a broad range of all sorts of approaches to public interest, social impact kind of design. And I think that's what made our podcast so very strong, is that it's available to people coming at in a lot of different ways.
I think what was really interesting to me was also how different interviews would eventually play off of each other. And of course, we never knew what people were going to say before they showed up and did the interview. But over the course of the year, you know, you're able to extract these themes of community, themes of empathy and resilience, and to look at 100 different ways in which people are making social change through design was profound, especially in the way that it took us in directions that we didn't understand at the beginning of this process. And Delight, I think it's notable that you singled out John Fetterman as one of your favorite interviews, someone who is not a designer. And we asked him during the interview whether he considered himself, you know, an urban planner, and he said no. But I think it speaks to the way that design can be transcendent, and people are designing all the time.
As, you know, Delight and Eric were mentioning, you know, we have some of our honorees that in fact are not designers. A lot of them are really facing an urgent problem, an urgent situation in their own community, in their own lives. And some in a very bizarre way, like I like to mention Koyo Koyo, you know, Line Ramstad, that found herself for strange tracks of life from Norway to Myanmar. And actually, to the community that of the Karen community that is originally from Myanmar, but that now lives on the other side of the border with Thailand. And really to face a situation in which these people were bullied out from their houses, if not sometimes even persecuted, and trying to understand what can architecture do to solve, you know, their immediate request, but also if there would be an architectural language that would give them a specific right or even an identity that would go beyond their just survival. So I think that some of these questions are really brought to a fundamental answer that is not only inspiring, but really shows that design, in fact, can do something that is beyond the shelter, that is really, you know, building an identity and somehow trying to understand how people can not only survive, but strengthen the community through what they do.
That was one of the sweetest of the interviews that I listened to. Just the ability that she had to dedicate herself to that particular spot and provide the maturity to really help the group.
That was another thing that emerged from me as, and I think Lina encompasses it very well, but, you know, a sort of commitment, a personal resiliency. And, you know, I hope all of our listeners take note that if you want to make change, you have to commit to it. You know, it's not something that falls out of a sketch. It is most often years of work and a level of personal commitment to a community in need that really makes this sort of change happen. And I think many of our interviewees and many of our Social Design Circle members speak to that, if not in their words, then certainly in their actions.
I guess maybe that's the part that makes me feel the best, that we did choose a group that exemplifies that.
So Cliff, Delight, after 10 years of a prize and 100 honorees last year, where do you see the future of the Curry Stone Foundation? What's up next?
Well, I think there's probably two basic directions that we're pursuing. And Delight's just pointing out that there's a third one. But for the so it's going to continue to evolve, of course. The first being education. And under that, our effort is really focused on the podcast, and Eric will talk about that a little bit more, because that's really our big feather that we're working. over time, there'll be other things that will connect in with that. And hopefully this next year, we can develop a number of them. And then the second thing is really the idea of going back into practice, and that we got this history of practice and we'd like to continue that history. We've been so fortunate to meet an architect from India who's been able to work with our former winners, and we've now created a design collaborative, Greystone Design Collaborative, in India. It's all a registered Indian company now, and we're going to specialize in slum design.
The third area is that we want to be able to continue to support our network, and we have a stronger connection between our various winners, the 26, and also the people that we honored this year. We hope to be able to work collaboratively with them in the future in India, and we also hope to be able to continue to support them in ways that they need to be supported on particular projects that they're doing.
So you're still building community.
Well, we're trying. I think that's just sort of like one of the cores, you know.
Also, I think what's true is our winners are still building community, yeah. And we have the good fortune to be able to connect them and let them do the heavy lifting.
In terms of the collaborative, can you maybe tell us a bit more how it works? Because it's quite interesting that, you know, you're working with the past winners, and you're working with basically communities of people that live in informality or the so-called slum dwellers. But how does the collaborative come into action? I mean, where is the where does it position?
We've got this company that was formed. Sandhya Nandu is the managing director. That's our gift to the world, is having her manage this effort with us giving a lot of guidance. She's got this unique ability with five different languages to an ability to be an architect, but sit down in a room full of slum and pavement dwellers and get into a discussion about what their needs are, what their aspirations are from a living standpoint. And then be able to also look at the government programs and the government systems and the international giving kinds of communities and take their considerations in mind as well as being able to also coordinate ourselves and bring other kinds of expertise into the thinking about how to create from the bottom up and the top down a better planned and executed slum.
We're looking forward to have a guest in the show, Sandhya, in the near future. But let's just directly go ahead in deepening this first new mission on education. So, Eric, I wanted to ask you, because we have been running this show together for 1 year now, and for me it's been really an honor to work with you, but what's up next?
Well, we've got a lot of things coming up, and it's going to be an exciting year, and you are going to be back reliably, right?
Hopefully.
Yeah, okay. No, we're going to be looking at several themes. You know, there are themes of technology and climate change, which are going to run through the entire year and everything that we do, but 2018 is dedicated to four basic tracks. We're going to be looking in one quarter at influence makers, people who are not designers, but people who have supported the social design movement, have created it through various institutions. We're going to be looking at disaster and resilience in a particular segment. We're going to spend one quarter looking at education and the teaching of social impact design and who are the faculty and deans and students out there that are really changing the way that design is taught across all disciplines and how it can be taught in a way that's more socially aware. But first quarter, and we'll be beginning next week with our guest John Kerry, is talking about resistance and how design can create resistance. How do we design resistance? And this is not exclusively an American phenomenon. We began by looking at all of the seismic political changes that have been happening in the world recently, from Trumpism to Brexit to Duterte's rise to power in the Philippines and now the potential move of the Israeli capital. How do designers position themselves? We have, all four of us, witnessed a social design movement grow up with the assistance and in the presence of certain supportive institutions and other institutions that are characterized by, let's say, benign neglect. And how do designers evolve when some of those institutions become outright hostile to the mission of providing better design to communities in need? So we've got a great slate of guests. You can go to our website and check them out. But we'll be leading off next week with John Kerry, who's going to give us a state of the union on the social design movement and some thoughts on how designers can evolve in the next decade.
Well, it seems wonderful. And are you going to be hosting this program alone?
No, we've got a couple of guest co-hosts coming in. You're one of them, obviously. And we've looked at several other people who are going to be subject matter experts in these various tracks that will be joining the show as well on limited runs to talk with our guests and draw out the important questions of the day.
Well, Cliff and Delight, thank you so much for being the show. Eric, it's been a pleasure as always, chatting with you. Good luck for the program for this year, and good luck to the Curry Stone Foundation for the upcoming challenges and, for the great ambitious plans that are laying ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're indebted to both of you.
And we are both indebted to you as well. Thank you for for our listening community. This would not be possible at all without Cliff and Delight's particular commitment to social impact design and their unflinching support.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We'd like to thank our guests of the week, Cliff Curry and Delight Stone, both for sharing their insights into the nature of socially impactful design and for their vision, which ultimately makes all of this possible. Next week, we're going to be kicking off a long arc and asking ourselves, can we design resistance? It's something we were thinking about for all of 2017 as our geopolitical landscape tilted on its axis. We've watched many of our friends, winners, and honorees grow their own practices over the last decade, some going on to win Aga Khan Awards and Pritzker Awards, and otherwise become household names. They built a movement with their design ability and their commitment to the common good. So what's next? How do we evolve in response to those who would legislate inequality, those who are proudly anti-democratic, anti-community, and even anti-human? I think it's time to double down, and that good design is fundamentally an act of resistance. So we're bringing together 10 thought leaders to see if I'm right. Tune in every Thursday, always, at socialdesigninsights.com. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Design Prize and the Curry Stone Foundation. If you haven't already, please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter for all the latest news on social impact design.